Well, good afternoon and thank you for this wonderful opportunity. And can I firstly say kaya, which is an Aboriginal greeting, and to acknowledge the Wadjuk Noongar people as the original custodians of the land we meet. It's a great privilege and thank you, Seda, for this opportunity for me to talk to you about issues that you read about in the media. You listen to the Gareth Parkers of the world you don't always hear it direct in an unfiltered way, so I intend to take the next 20 minutes to really thematically talk about numbers, because there are a number of economists in the room, and I know you love data, so I'm going to regale you with plenty of data charts. I want to talk about priorities, because I strongly believe that we are a product of our priorities, and we've got to have those priorities set. And I'll close off on people. Look, I'll just warn you, some of my numbers will be a bit foreboding and they will appear rather gloomy. But I want to speak, as I say, in an unfiltered, factual way based on both my past experience and the contemporary data sets that we have facing us as a West Australian and indeed national community. But I will focus on a positive at the end, so don't get too despondent. The opportunity for us to look at data first, when I was CEO of the Australian Crime Commission and the Australian Institute of Criminology, I was going through exactly what my senior executive and I are going through right now. That is preparing for ERC bilats, and Mr. Ripper, of course, is with us, and I remember appearing before him and other cabinet colleagues. And I'm about to do that next Tuesday. As I prepared for the Commonwealth experience, I thought, well, why don't I get some figures and wrap that around what is the impact of serious and organised crime on the nation? Because how am I to articulate and put a budget bid forward unless I present the actual picture? So the infographic on the left came up with a set of numbers that I'd asked a number of criminologists, economists and actuaries to actually crunch the numbers of what is really not reported through tax returns, and nor is it really a market that you can actually really properly understand unless you try and put and quantify what the cost of serious and organised crime is to this nation. After 18 months, and they got it internationally peer-reviewed, $36 billion was what was estimated in a very conservative process. And that, of course, in 2014, equated to 24% of what this nation spends in its social security budget. It also equates to some 200-odd baskets of groceries at about $167 a pop. The impact on each of us in every Australian's working would be equivalent to about 3 weeks' pay. So it's a big cost economically. Of course, the cost isn't just one that is represented by money, but the impact it has on everyday lives. That process was repeated just before I left the AIC, the Institute of Criminology, in 2017. And you can see that the public spend, that is the green infographic on the right, indicates that we're spending about the same amount in terms of the public law enforcement bodies and government agencies that are dealing with serious and organised crime, and indeed the private sector. You know, the way you're protecting your systems through cyber, the way in which householders are and business owners are having to put and wrap around security to protect their investments and their business. But the impact on the community, there's a person behind every crime and there's a victim, a real person behind each of these crimes. So, look, we heard from Rick and Michael and others about forecasting for the future. If there is a recession, I'm pleased that there hasn't been one for 28 odd years, but my business goes up in a recession. So I don't run out of clients. In fact, they improve. So I'm not really in sales. I'm here to try and deal with matters. In having priorities, the Premier only last week set out what he termed our priorities. And three of those priorities that he expressed last week are represented here. In reducing the over-representation of Aboriginal people in custody, a very stretched target of reducing that by 23% over the next 10 years. A very real current issue, and I'll expand on that to reinforce why that is such a critical issue facing our community. Reducing youth offending, which is wrapped up very heavily in that other priority. And I'll also commence my discussion with you about the reduction of illicit drug use. That's a pretty scary target for me. I'm not the only person. Police are only part of the way of addressing illicit drug use in our community. And I'll expand on why that is. But to reduce illicit drug use by 15% within about 3 years is a significant challenge, but one that we're ready to address. Illicit drug use, it's very hard, as I mentioned earlier, to actually say, well, how deep is this market? I mean, drug dealers don't put in ABNs and they don't really like doing tax returns. So how deep is this market? How pervasive is it? And is it just a national one or is it an international one? So one way in which we commenced 4 years ago in understanding the depth and spread of illicit drug use was to actually sample over half the Australian population. When a person smokes, snorts, injects methamphetamine, that metabolises in the body, and as that gets excreted, it goes through the wastewater system, and we've got people from universities who then do dip samples. That sounds like a fun job. And they dip sample the metabolites in the wastewater system. That then, in very good, solid scientific validity, can then give us not only what type of drugs are being ingested and used by Australians, but also the quantities. It's quite an exact science. It's been used in Europe for quite a number of years. But Australia is the first nation in the world to, in fact, do this on a national scale. And it is, of course, dependent on a whole lot of algorithms and ways in which it can happen. You've heard a lot about meth. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I put to you that if you don't have a member of your immediate family or a neighbour, someone that works for you, that hasn't either a direct addiction or they have often a child or a friend or some connection to someone that is addicted to meth in Western Australia, it would be unusual. Some of you have that within your immediate families. I have very close friends who have had their children, now adults, addicted to this for many years. WA, unfortunately, presents itself as the highest consumer of methamphetamine, otherwise known as ICE, speed, or whatever they like to call it. This detailed graph, if you look at the far right, that is Western Australia's usage. In the red column to the extreme right of that graph, it easily shows that in our regional areas outside of Perth, methamphetamine is the highest use in Australia. And as a capital city, Perth has been tracking along with Adelaide as being the largest consumers of meth. I get asked lots of questions, and Deb may repeat those questions to me in the Q&A following, as to why. This next slide shows you that meth being on the left, this is just the WA stats, and underneath that you'll see in the column immediately next to meth, cocaine basically doesn't present itself as an illicit drug use in WA. If I showed you the Sydney chart would be quite the opposite. Sydney is the major consumer of cocaine, and some of that is about obviously demand and supply, something this audience should know about very well. MDMA, which is otherwise known as ecstasy, again, while it presents, we see oxycodone, which is a pharmaceutical drug but is subject to extensive abuse as an analgesic. Fentanyl, again, and I'll touch on this on another slide later, is emerging as a very concerning drug problem. Heroin is not presently a market that WA is experiencing very heavily, but Melbourne is. And so in understanding what is the nature of our problem, this is one that's been known for quite some time. So the Australian Institute of Criminology have been conducting urinalysis. So when we arrest someone for any type of charge and they go into the Perth Watch House or lockup, we have people who are contracted and they come in and ask the detainee, what are you here for? And this is done in a voluntary way. And surprisingly, the detainees and prisoners there actually participate. And they, with their consent, provide their urine for analysis. And that is demonstrating now, since 2009, now over 10 years, that the incidence of meth being in the system of a prisoner arrested has risen from some average of 15% to now in the mid-70s. So basically 7 to 8 out of 10 prisoners and persons that police charge going through the Perth Watch House are using meth. I hear some uninformed commentators who say, oh, look, it's just the same number of people and they're using heavily or whatever. I refute that, and we've got scientific validity to back that up. So we know it's been an increasing problem and is continuing to trend that way. Not forgetting the slide I put up earlier about reducing by 15% within 3 years, you can see why this is a major focus for us. It's not just in the law enforcement sector. This is Health Department of WA data sets, which again show between 2007 to 2017, 10-year period, and you will know this yourself if you've visited an emergency department at one of our major hospitals, those people that are adversely impacted on meth use, you can see it for yourselves. If you go into RPH or Fiona Stanley tonight, or right as I'm speaking now, you will see people that are quite severely impacted on meth use. It's not always exclusively meth. They are poly users. They are people that will smoke cannabis. They will drink alcohol. They will inject all sorts of substances. But meth presents as an overwhelming problem. There's a relationship between meth use and harm. I find this particular graph very important because that's a merger of sets out of the wastewater consumption set, and that's the bottom one, the light blue line, which goes like a railway track synonymously with the emergency department presentations. So what we've seen over the last 2 years is a very, very close correlation between people who consume meth, that we are assessing how many there are, and the numbers of people that present to emergency departments. So as I say, it's impacting right across all of our sectors, but that's probably one of the most evident ones. This quick stat, and I'll get away from stats shortly, shows us that in Perth, through wastewater testing, we're estimating between 27 and 30 kilo of meth is being consumed every week in Perth. If you're a drug trafficker, and a lot of these drugs are coming from countries such as China, Iran, Myanmar and others, less so being produced in Australia. Why are they doing this? Again, to overcook the supply and demand economic sort of modelling. If you're going to make $1 million out of every kilo, why wouldn't you come here? And that's what's costing us as a community. Apart from the human misery and harms, there's about $28 million spent by consumption of meth in Perth City alone every week. The purity has risen from 20 years ago under 10% purity to tracking in the mid-70s. So it's a much more potent drug which is now being consumed. And as I mentioned earlier, most of it is coming by volume from overseas. Most of it by weight through maritime shipments, some by air, some through the darknet, internet, postal system, and we obviously work very closely with all those other service providers to try and disrupt and interrupt importations. This graph shows the clandestine laboratory detections, which I often refer to as subsistence labs, where people were cooking them up and blowing off the roofs of houses and all sorts of things. It's quite a volatile process. Or it might be a small bottle in the back seat of a car, and they're simply trying to cook up, they download it from the internet, they get precursors on various sort of chemicals, and we're of course regulating and disrupting precursor chemicals, but that clearly demonstrates, up to last year's stats, we only detected 15 such labs and they were small. I'm not suggesting that there aren't people that are cooking on a higher volume in Australia, but certainly That's the West Australian stats, and they're consistent with the same that we see in every other state and territory across Australia. So people are no longer cooking in the volume they once were. They're simply, why would you take that risk when you can buy it on the street? One of the strategies that we're using is to follow the money. The traffickers themselves, particularly the international ones that are impacting on our community, are offshore, they're directing activities onshore. These people don't ever come to Australia. They are people who are well versed in international financial systems. They must put their money somewhere. You'll see then that last year we've seized $11 million in cash and seized about $40 million in assets. But this must be a methodology that we will continue, and I expect that that will continue to be the approach, because we're finding that is a good way of disrupting. In terms of seizures, what police are doing, you can see that that graph since 2012-13 has basically just skyrocketed. We estimate through wastewater testing that the total consumption of tonnage for meth alone in Australia is between 8 and 9 tonnes. WA, on that basis, have used around about 1.5 tonne of meth per year. We seized about 1.5 tonne last year. So it's clearly not all designed for our market. So what we've disrupted here was also destined for other parts of Australia. If we continue that, and that'll be a challenge, because a lot of that was out of a major operation that we conducted, which resulted in a big seizure at Geraldton, which came from offshore. Those sorts of operations are very, very important to disrupt. This is an even scarier slide. I will get a bit more positive with you later. But I just want to give you the context that on the markets that are being dealt with, the DEA warned me some 5 years ago, watch out for opioids in terms of the way it's tracked in the US. The number of 47,000 people who died in 2017 in USA alone in the last calendar year rose to 70,000 people. For about 7 to 8% of the world population, North Americans consume over 90% of the world's analgesics. I've got family in the US. My extended family live there, and their medicine cabinets are full of pills. They overconsume, they overprescribe, and so that is a cultural issue. And what's happened here is that people who've been addicted to prescription opioids have migrated across to street heroin, and that is resulting in primarily Mexican cartels industrialising labs and flooding the US streets with street heroin, and that is why the US is receiving such a large casualty in terms of that. So to jump straight from that particular challenging set of numbers to talk then about Aboriginal communities in Western Australia, and one of the priorities the Premier announced was about Aboriginal wellbeing. Why am I putting these together? Not to suggest that Aboriginal people are the only ones that have this problem. This is not attributable to Aboriginality, but there is a nexus that I'll expand on and close my discussion with you on why these two priorities are very critical for us. Aboriginal wellbeing, to put the context around it, the WA population, about 2.5 million, the ABS stats estimate just in excess of 75,000 Western Australians are of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander heritage. Around 3% of our state population. Most of it is urbanised, 72%, rural, 26%, and quite a young population. Life expectancy, though, to unpack that from the top down, the average life expectancy for, this is a national figure, for a white female or non-Aboriginal female is in excess of 80 years of age. And yet, if you go down the bottom of that, if I can read correctly, the life expectancy for a WA adult male is 65 years. So the mortality rate and life expectancy is quite significant. And the labour market, there's just under 48% nationally Aboriginal people in full-time employment. Aboriginal homicides and victims. These are people who are far more likely to be victims of crime than non-Aboriginal people. So when I speak about Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal people, this is not to try and skew my message to say that they are overrepresented in the justice system just as persons who are convicted as offenders. Aboriginal people are far more likely to be victims of crime than non-Aboriginal people. It is a whole of community issue, and a person likely to be a victim of homicide, if you're Aboriginal, is in the order of 8 out of 10 likely to be impacted by alcohol and or other substances such as meth, and it is in stark contrast to the likelihood, if you're a non-Aboriginal person, of being a victim. You would have read or may know of this particular challenge. Nationally, there are 43,000 prisoners in our adult prisons, and we have a stat which is very, very challenging. Nationally, 28, just under 3 out of 10 prisoners nationally are Aboriginal people. In WA, it's more like 4 out of 10, nearly 40% of Aboriginal adult prisoners of Aboriginal heritage. Even in the last 3 years, you can see that the numbers of Aboriginal persons in custody have risen from 2,100 to 2,700 in our WA prisons. If you're a child, if you're an Aboriginal youth, you are more likely to populate Banksia Hill. 7 or 8 out of 10 of those detainees are Aboriginal, coming from 3% of the population. And you say, well, why is this so? Why do we need a stretch target? Well, we do need a target because the system's not improving. Nearly 40 years ago, I joined police when I was about 5, by the way, but I was stationed in a small country town. I went back there about a year ago and I asked the question of the constables in the station that I once worked, are you dealing with so-and-so? I still remember their date of birth, their full name, because I'd charged them so many times. And they said, yep, we're dealing with their grandkids, we're dealing with their sons and daughters, and we're still dealing with him. I asked after another name, same thing. Yep, we're dealing with them, yep, we're still dealing with their grandkids, and the cycle keeps on repeating. As I drove the 400 kilometres back to Perth, I said to my wife, who was with me on that trip, you know, something's got to happen here. Because if a future commissioner goes back to the place where they worked, whether she or he asked the same question, would they get a different response? And my firm conviction is nothing would change unless we change. The cycle has got worse. It's not got better. And we must do something different. And I'll lapse into an Einstein quote if I go too much further. But we'll repeat the same mistakes unless we change as a community. And certainly in the organisation I lead, I'm inspired by Ronnie's very inspirational talk there. It's the people within policing that we and I see every day that are dealing with this 24/7. And I'm not exclusively saying police alone are doing it. We work with many, many other great partners. But for frontline officers who deal with this day in, day out, my job is to lead. And I want to lead change in our culture and our attitude, and I'll expand a bit further on that. But if we don't change and we don't influence the system, the cycle of despair and hopelessness will continue. The issues on crime are real. I've spoken to that issue already. We also police the largest landmass, that is a single police jurisdiction in the world, 2.5 million square kilometres. So what is happening in downtown CBD Perth and what's happening in a remote facility such as Warrakoona or Balgo is thousands and thousands of kilometres apart. And indeed those communities run and operate quite differently. So that is also a challenge that we must meet in the way we are both resourced, the way we deploy, the way we operate. And some of the communities have their own privations. I'm very much not in the business of FIFOing police or didoing, as I call, or camel in, camel out, as used to happen, because you can't build trust and you can't build relationships with communities by simply going and doing a service execution and execute a warrant and then arrest someone and take them out. You've got to build trust and you've got to build that rapport and relationship with the people that we live with and that we communicate with. But our business is about law enforcement, and this slide pie chart will demonstrate that around half the people that we arrest or summons in the bush are Aboriginal people. And yet, if my recall is right, it was only in the order of some 26-odd thousand people of Aboriginal heritage live in the bush. And we have in the order of 20 to 25% of the people that we arrest or summons in the city are Aboriginal heritage, and yet they are such a small proportion of our population. I won't unpack that, but we are charging in excess of 100,000 people a year. So what are we doing? I made an apology to Aboriginal people in July last year during NAIDOC Week. In anticipation of that, I knew I'd cop some criticism, but it wasn't meant to be a populist statement to apologise on behalf of WA Police Force to Aboriginal people. There was a couple of drivers to that. If you think about reconciliation, and I'll touch a little bit about that as we go on further. If we're dealing with a matrimonial or a relationship in which there's been a division and a lack of trust, how are those parties going to reconcile unless one party make a move or both parties make a move? If you simply stand off and point the finger at each other, how can you repair that relationship? And I felt it very important to repair the relationship. Sitting alongside me when I made that reconciliation speech, sitting next to my wife, was Dr. Sue Gordon. I've got Sue's permission to talk about this. Sue was taken from her family in Meekatharra as a three-year-old in the 1940s. Sue was described in the police report as a quadroon, a quarter caste. I've read the police report. Sue's kindly allowed me to talk and read about that. She was described by the police constable as too white to stay with her family. And they are the words that were actually used. It further expanded and said, we know her mother's going to pine, but we need to be able to give her a chance. So we'll be removing her. Now, they were executing a policy of the day. It wasn't driven or designed by police, but we were working under the Native Protector, and that was part of the police duty. I said to Sue, who I've known for many years, Sue, has anyone ever said sorry to you about that from police? She said, no. And I said, well, we're about to. The issues are so profound in terms of the intergenerational trauma. In Aboriginal Creole, they call police mona, and monarch is an Aboriginal term in which they simply call police. If you think about it this way, what might the conversation happen? If you're raising a child and you say, well, the police are coming, well, watch out, because they took me away from my family, or they took your grandmother away from their family. The police did that. How do you build trust if you're brought up with that trauma and that harm? And so I needed to say sorry on behalf of the harms that had been done in the past, and indeed to repair the trust that we need to and are presently rebuilding. So aside from making a very important public statement about that, in which I've got, yeah, I did get a little bit of negative feedback, but very overwhelmingly and almost universally from Aboriginal people, they were thankful that, in fact, that apology was made. It's very significant for them as a people. So we've commenced with building an Aboriginal affairs strategy. I was always troubled, and now I'm in the position to do something about it. We've always had a strategy about road safety in policing. We've always had a strategy about drugs. We've always had a strategy about liquor licensing. We've always had a strategy about burglaries and all sorts of crime types. And yet when you know, and I could expand on many more, we've never actually had an overt strategy or plan about how we police in Aboriginal communities. And for me, it was appallingly profound that we needed to have a very clear strategy. I think we just normalised it. It's part of our business. And we'd never actually had a concerted strategy around that. So that strategy is underway. It's not yet complete, but we're building on it. Part of that is by taking advice from senior Aboriginal elders from across the state. So I regularly meet with a forum of advisors, and they give me, through their lens, how we're tracking and give us advice and forum. I've actually got them sitting on our selection panels now. So the most recent appointee, a wonderful woman in Kununurra, as a senior sergeant, she was selected for that position on merit, and part of the selection panel was a senior Aboriginal elder there. That way they get buy-in as well, because they've selected their officer in charge. And it's one way of actually engaging the community in ensuring that we can actually continue that trust. There are a whole lot of other strategies, some not exclusively police, but they're about custody notification services, about recruiting, and I'll touch further on that, and cultural training. Not just at the police academy, because a recruit might get a few days training there, but getting induction and training in the communities they serve. Because indeed, the connections with country and the various mobs around our great state do have, in fact, their own culture and their own nuances in which they want to ensure that police officers know when they're engaging, how that can be done in a respectful way, what parts of the country they're not permitted to go, because it might be a particular men-only or women-only place for them to go, so that they don't unwittingly create disharmony and disrespect by not understanding how to work with the local people. The Aboriginal Staff Network, we obviously have a number of Aboriginal officers here doing a great job, but flying the police flag. In raising the flag outside of headquarters, my four winters in Canberra, as I characterise it, I was quite used to the four flags being flown in front of every Commonwealth building. And yet it struck me that I first walked into the police headquarters in East Perth in 1975. And when I got back from Canberra, I actually, in this, it's an oft-used cliche, I don't like using cliches, but in this unconscious bias, I didn't actually realise there wasn't an Aboriginal flag out front of police headquarters. It had just never been there. And yet, I'd been walking in and out of that building for 40-odd years. But in the lesson that I learnt coming out of the situation I was in was that I realised this is really important for Aboriginal people. So what have we done further? We've employed Aboriginal cadets, and I've used special measures under the EO Act to only recruit Aboriginal cadets. Non-Indigenous people can apply as constable recruits and as police staff, but I'm intentionally employing cadets. We've got 58 in total. This young woman here, Maddie Ugel, and I've got her consent to talk about Maddie's story in closing as a story of hope. Maddie's mum was murdered in 2016. Maddie came from a very tough upbringing. Her and her three siblings were living in a home punctuated by not just a loving mother, but a mother that was addicted to meth, as was her partner. Maddie's mum was murdered. Her partner was convicted of her murder. And in the year that Maddie joined, she was giving evidence in the Supreme Court trial that resulted in the conviction of the man who murdered her mother. Maddie had the background to face not just a very difficult upbringing, but she had to face decisions in her life as to what she'd do about it. Her older sister had the similar challenge, as indeed did her older brother. Her older brother, talented footballer, played for Collingwood. Her older sister now plays for Essendon and was captain of the under-23 WA AFL side. Maddie herself, a talented footballer, and she is the state under-18 women's football captain. But Maddie has told me this personally herself. She said, "I decided to make a difference and become a role model to my people." Maddie's now working at Laverton. Unsurprisingly, she's started a young girls football team. Great work. And I see people like Maddie as an absolute inspiration and a beacon of hope that we can continue to build and build strength in our Aboriginal people. And she's far better equipped than I am to understand culture and how she can positively be a role model to Aboriginal youth and people and add to the wonderful work that our non-Aboriginal officers are doing. But it adds a great amount of skill and a great amount of cultural understanding to complement the work that we're more broadly doing. So hence, there is a nexus between the illicit drug use. There is a nexus between the priorities that the Premier and the government have set to our everyday business. Leaving you with a challenge. I don't want you to poach Maddie. She's got lots of important work to do. What I do put to you as a challenge is you're captains of industry. You have very senior roles, if not running your own business, in the senior roles you undertake within your respective agencies. You know about it. What are you doing about it? What challenge can you take away from here and go, I can make a difference. I can actually help sponsor, foster, mentor in whatever way you can. Or we can sit back and go, well, isn't that sad? And not do anything about it. So that's my message to you, and I wish you well. And I think I'm going to be heading for questions. Maddie's not the only person, by the way. I think I've got a little video just to close off on.
I've just always wanted to be a police officer. I think that me being an Aboriginal person, I feel they're more culturally comfortable to come and speak to me about certain things that they wouldn't speak to with other officers.
Derby is it's a big town, predominantly Aboriginal town, although we have a team of really dedicated police officers here who are very experienced in what they do. We simply don't have that insight into Aboriginal people that other Aboriginal people have.
I love coming to work every day, and this is probably the best choice that I've ever made.